Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast, back for another week. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host there. And joining me across the water, all the way from San Diego, is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, we speak to a lot to each other these days, don't we? We've been doing pods and pods and pods over the last couple of days, so we've seen a lot of each other, and that's very good because it means we're still going, mate. So let's keep this going for another 5 years, right?
Yeah, exactly. The omens are good. We recorded a podcast exclusively on the Clásico at the weekend where Real Madrid beat Barcelona 2-1. That's on our Patreon, as is our postbox, where we work through all the big stories from the Premier League. There's also Princess Pata over there, where I've talked through a lot of the other big stories in Europe that we were asked about. So we'd love you to come and join us over on the Patreon. Today, we're going to be talking about some surprise packages, which are have emerged over the start of the season from the Premier League through Serie A and Bundesliga. I'm going to talk a little bit about La Liga and Liga as well, because there's some exciting storylines going on. They're all surprise packages in different ways, we should point out. But before we get to that, I think it is worth us looking back, doing a little bit of a things we love, Dean. We haven't done one for a couple of weeks, and having a little bit of a chat about the Clásico, which did dominate the headlines at the weekend.
Yeah, it was a thing I loved. Like, it was a crazy game, and it was a throwback game, and it really makes us now look forward to the next Clásico, which currently is scheduled for May, but I'm hoping we do get one before that date. I'm pretty sure we will. But yeah, it was, obviously we went over this in the Patreon, but for all of the thousands of you that aren't on the Patreon, why aren't you there? But okay, we'll do it all over again. It was mad. Like, we had the outlandish, outrageous behavior of Vinicius Jr. We had Lamine Yamal starting feuds with his mouth, and then things got a bit carried away on that front, didn't they? That was all a bit silly. But in between, the actual game itself, Real Madrid just dominated, and it was a completely deserved win. It was not, there's no way as a Barcelona fan that you could look at the game itself and have complaints, because it could have easily been a 4-1 Madrid game, a 5-1 Madrid game, disallowed goals, penalties overturned. Very, very small moments in the game that didn't go their way when they could have. And Barca, like, it looked for a while like they might keep themselves in the game, but they ultimately couldn't turn it in their favour. And look, they've got injuries at the moment. Like, that's okay. Like, this wasn't an embarrassment by any stretch of the imagination. But for Madrid, it was convincing enough that they will spend this week very much reliving it, enjoying it, unless you're Vinny, in which case you're probably on the naughty step, I'd imagine. Do you think Vinny's on the naughty step this week? Do you think they have that?
I don't know, right? Like, it's one of those bizarre questions about Vinicius' performance. Was really impressive, right? Like, in terms of what he put together on the field, the creativity, the fact that he was on that left-hand side, and it looked like, and I thought this was really clever from Xabi Alonso, the fact that they tried to build up on that right, and the fact he was Camavinga over there a lot of the time, meant he came inside on that left foot and switch play to open up channels for Vinicius to really get at them, and Alvaro behind him as well. But, you know, trying to isolate him against a defender, and we saw that kind of come to fruition time and time again over the course of the game. Is he a little bit unlucky not to win a penalty in the first half? Yeah, I think so. I think that he probably has the right to be a bit frustrated about that. I think it evened out, because I think the one in the second half wasn't 100% a stonewall, shall we say. The deflections made that incredibly difficult to deal with. But, you know, the fact is that he's had a brilliant 70 minutes or so there in the Clásico, right? And at that point, at 2-1, the game is starting to open out. We're seeing Jules Koundé come into it a little bit more. And Vinicius is hooked, and there's a change made. And he obviously decides that he's going to storm off down the tunnel. And, you know, the report suggests that he said, that's it, I'm done. I'm, you know, I don't want to play for this club anymore, or things to that extent. And there's obviously a level of frustration about being substituted in a game where you're having joy from an offensive perspective. And I understand that. But you can't act like that to your manager because it suggests that you think you are bigger than the club. Right. And look, I love Vinicius. I love the fact that he takes on players. I love the fact that he winds people up. I'm a huge, huge Vinicius Jr. fan, right? Like, I absolutely adore what he does on a football pitch. But I think to basically disrespect your manager in that way when you've been substituted is absolutely fine. Like, and I stress this again, to be annoyed about being substituted. Like, that shows you care. And in a game like that, where you're on the biggest stage, perhaps in world football, obviously you want the opportunity to make your mark for as long as possible. But I think it was a correct tactical decision from Xabi Alonso, right? I think that at that moment, you're seeing it and Rodrigo comes on and he works incredibly hard both ways and they're able to stifle any Barcelona attacks towards the end of the game with aplomb down that side. So for him to basically be like, the manager is making the wrong decision, I think suggests a level of kind of frustration that probably goes beyond being substituted in a game. And we know that there's been kind of a simmering tension there since the Club World Cup and the fact that he hasn't started every game, the fact he's been subbed in a lot of them. There are, you know, rumors that come out of Vinicius' camp all the time about the fact that he's not, you know, completely happy with his role at the club, and Kylian Mbappe becoming the main man has probably wound him up a little bit as well. But on the whole, I look at it and I think, you know, you have to be able to accept that the manager wants to put his stamp on this and that you have been a crucial part of what turned out to be an incredible win. The first time that Real Madrid have won a Clásico in what, 550 odd days? So it's been a long time since they've kind of had this feeling. A team that did them on numerous occasions last year, you've come out of that with a win. If they'd lost every game this season and, you know, they were losing and he came off and he was frustrated about it, I'd have a little bit more sympathy with all of these. But ultimately, Real Madrid are 5 points clear at the top of the table. And it's a real shame that we are sat here talking about this instead of what was an absolutely incredible performance, but it has taken the headlines.
Yeah, it definitely has. And to just like consider how you would feel in this moment, like, not obviously everyone that listens to this pod would support Real Madrid or Barcelona, but whoever your team's star player is, just think how you would feel if they threw a tantrum like the one that Vinny threw, and then we'll say, I'm leaving. What's the point of me being here? It's always me, or whatever it was that he said. But like, are you putting up with it? Do you handle those moments for the good moments? Are there enough good moments? Do you believe that it's for the benefit of the team that he can act like that? It's a tough one because some people will be like, yeah, you just put up with it. What if it's Haaland at Man City? What if Haaland does that? Can't lose him. Like, won't score a goal ever again.
I do think you put up with it, considering how well Vinny played. But like, you also need to find a solution that doesn't end in this every time he's substituted, right? Like, you don't see all the other... For look, Mastantuono had a bit of a throw his hands up in the air moment when he got substituted as well, right? Like, there was an element of that that you look at and think, okay, right, there's just like elements of this that are difficult. Not in this game, obviously, he didn't start. But like, in other games, he's been frustrated being substituted. But... like, there's a difference between being frustrated at substituted and storming down the tunnel. Like, you have to, there needs to be a lid put on it. And I think Xabi Alonso is doing a really good job of turning this Real Madrid tanker around, right? Like, and putting a tactical stamp on it. I thought they were absolutely brilliant to a man at the weekend. And like, they should be celebrated for what they put together on the pitch, not, you know, we're sitting here and talking about other things. And ultimately, Vinicius has done that, right? Like, by storming down the tunnel, he's directed the narrative back to, oh, is there a problem between Alonso and Vinicius? Rather than, how good were Real Madrid at the weekend? I feel like that's a shame. And it's something that, you know, you don't want to see because you don't want to be talking about these things.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, threatening to leave the club because you're substituted just isn't good. But we've seen massive turnarounds before with players and their situations, like in these sorts of scenarios, or like the one where...
I don't think he's going anywhere, right? Like, I think that's heat at the moment stuff.
Yeah, and like, he's a long way from a transfer window at this moment. So like, he can't just sit there sulking until January when probably nobody can afford him. So like, him leaving isn't really an option right now. So he should probably realize that as well. But yeah, you think of like when Granit Xhaka was at Arsenal that time and like he was getting booed and like basically swearing at his own fan base. And he turned that around. So you could turn anything around and this will be forgotten very quickly, I think. I think that that's what Vinny needs to do. And as a fan base, you'll be willing to move on very quickly as long as he does his talking with his feet in the right way and not stamping them rather than doing some step overs and scoring some goals. Like, that's what he needs to be back to. But it was a really good performance. I thought Mbappe looked really sharp. Like, as I say, like, just fine, fine lines between him being on and offside and, like, unbelievable strikes. And Barca have got some work to do now to get them the season turning back their way. Not an easy task at all, but definitely not. This is not done. Far from it. Like, and that's one of the most promising things. I was saying on the Patreon, one of the things that did make me laugh was Pedri's shirt pull. So if I was to rank my favourite parts of the Clásico, honestly, Pedri's shirt pull might have been number one because it was just like so aggressive and desperate and sincere. I've never seen someone so desperately pulling someone back as Pedri was in that moment. And then there's the whole Lamine Yamal fallout as well, which will probably carry on. Like, I'd say the Vinicius noise is more... Is it more obvious, do you think, the Vinny stuff than the Lamine stuff?
I think the Lamine Yamal story felt bigger in the moment. I think that in terms of the fallout, there's probably going to be, you know, that will be not forgotten because obviously what's happened is what's happened. But what will, you know, the legacy of this Clásico will be that Real Madrid were dominant and really deserved a win against Barcelona for the first time in a while. But people will talk about Vinicius and what happens next and like whether there is potential that he leaves, etc., far longer than they will talk about Lamine Yamal, who said them things ahead of the Clásico. Most of the players from a Real Madrid perspective were like, I don't mind. It was fine. Like, Tchouaméni came out afterwards and was like, he can say what he wants. Like, it's done on the pitch. And Lamine Yamal can say what he wants. And ultimately, he didn't back up those statements with a performance in this Clásico, which is a frustrating one for him. It will be frustrating for Barcelona fans, totally. There was also the element of what he said before the game against Portugal in the Nations League, which backfired a little bit as well. And I think that, you know, obviously Lamine Yamal is young, right? Like, he's still learning his trade in terms of not just the game, which he's incredibly good at, but also in terms of managing how he deals with the bits and bobs around it. I think that those comments, you know, I've watched them back now, and it was at a Kings League thing. It's all said with a kind of smirk and relatively ingest. And obviously everything is amplified to the nth degree these days, and especially when it's the Clásico, right? And you can take that from bits of the game, right? When there was referees coming out and saying, oh, it's a penalty to Barcelona. If this wasn't a Clásico, then it would be a penalty to Barcelona. And you've got the other bit where Real Madrid get a penalty overturned and an offside in the first half of this game. And the crowd are yelling corruption in the Federation and Negreira, right? Like, there's like everything gets amplified so much. And, you know, we'll talk about both of these things within that context. But like, ultimately, I do think that Lamine Yamal said something and it's wound up the Real Madrid players. They've obviously got a kind of boost out of it. They've dominated. Carreras had a brilliant game at left back and has kind of stood up to Lamine Yamal. Again, it is worth pointing out, he had an excellent game against him when he was playing for Benfica last season. And, you know, the next time they meet, Lamar will want to put that right. Right. So there is an element of all of this, I think.
I'm glad hate each other. I want them to hate each other.
The best Clásicos are when there is genuine bite and rivalry to this one. And it feels like that's returning. And I think that that's a good thing.
Definitely is a good thing. Like, it's going to be spicy as we move forward. Like, it lost its mojo a little bit, this fixture, in the years after Messi and Ronaldo. And there was some good games along the way, but like, because you didn't always have the big names or the big moments, the big headlines around those games, it was interesting, but sometimes not much more than that. Like, this was dramatic. And Vinicius and Lamine starting wars is like just a great narrative. Like, and it's going to get people watching more of La Liga, watching more of Clásicos. And that leads into the Champions League. It leads into Ballon d'Or. It leads into all these sorts of narratives as well. So that's what's fun about it. And it
the
might
fact that they come up against each other on the same flank, I think, is also unbelievably fun. The fact that, you know, we obviously watch Messi and Ronaldo come up against each other all the time, but very rarely did they actually come into contact in terms of actually on the pitch. Whereas you see this, you know, there's the penalty where it's Lamine Yamal who trips Vinicius. You know, there are tackles between the two of them. They're like actually going head to head at points in this game, which I think is a great narrative in itself.
Yeah, And that's why I hope Vinny does stay at Real Madrid. Like, I don't want him to go anywhere. I want this to become a thing. Like, he can be annoyed, but just get over it. Like, Xavi Alonso will put an end to this. Like, he's said himself, like, you've got different personalities in a team and you've got to deal with them. And that's right. He is right. And like, you'll have some volatile characters. You'll have some quiet characters and all everything in between. And clearly, Vinny's at the top end of that, and it's part of Xabi Alonso's management growth that he'll have to deal with that and see if he can keep a lid on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But a very, very exciting Clásico to start the season.
Well done, Madrid.
Everywhere.
Well done, Madrid. Enjoy very, very it. Sorry, Barca fans, but you'll get a chance for revenge at some point.
Yeah, well, probably in the Super Cup in January. I think is probably the first time we'll see that happen. So fingers crossed that we will see these two meet multiple times over the course of this season. Just before we move on to the main segment, I did want to highlight something that we didn't talk about. We did sacking or saving managers for the fifth time a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things I wanted to point out was that all of the managers we did on version 4 in the October of last year, Erik ten Hag, Lopetegui, Gary O'Neill, Russell Martin, Fonseca, Sadio Mané, Ivan Juric at Roma, and Ruben Baraja were all sacked within 12 months of the episode dropping. Mm-hmm. And we have now seen the first manager mentioned on this season's Sacking or Saving Europe's Under 5 Managers, version 5. Go back and listen a couple of weeks ago if you missed it. Igor Tudor was spoken about at Juventus. No longer Juventus manager. So the first casualty of sacking or saving Europe's under fire managers has happened of the season.
Yeah, he didn't really stand a chance in the end, did he?
No, if you don't win for 8 games in a row as Juventus manager.
Yeah, that escalated.
Too many draws, Thiago Motta only ever didn't win for 5 games in a row. So...
That was not a good moment for him, but it was a good moment for Ranks FC because our radar is bang on, mate.
Spot on, per se. And I think we both said that we didn't expect that one to last much longer. All right, so let's take a break there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about this season's surprise packages and whether they can stay as high as they currently are within their respective leagues. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC, and it's time for our main ranking. It's been a little while since we did one of these main rankings per se, but I've got a couple of teams, 6 teams in fact, from across the European scope, from across the big 5 leagues, who are surprise packages in their leagues for a variety of different reasons, Dean. I want to work through just what's made them so good at the start of the season, and then we can have a little discussion on whether or not we think they can stay there. So I'm going to start in the Premier League, and I'm going to start with Bournemouth, who are currently second in the Premier League table, 4 points behind leaders Arsenal. They haven't lost since the opening day against Liverpool. And even then, I thought Bournemouth were a little bit unlucky to not get something at Anfield after they roared back from being 2-0 down. So in the summer, Bournemouth lost Dean Huijsen, Ilya Zubanyi, Milos Kerkez, Kepa Arrizabalaga, Dango Ouattara, and Luis Sinisterra. And in through the door, they got Georgi Petrovic, Adrien Truffert, Bafodé Diakite, Amini Adli, Ben Gannon-Doak, Veliko Milosavljevic, and Alex Jimenez. So Bournemouth finished 9th last season in the Premier League, which was their best ever finish in terms of both position and points. Joint best in terms of position and best ever in terms of points. But the incredible start to this season is framed under the banner that Bournemouth lost 4 of their starting back 5 from last season in Kepa, Zubanyi, Huijsen, and Kerkez, 3 of whom are now regularly starting for some of the biggest clubs in the world and who went for huge money. Kepa actually also went to a gigantic club in Arsenal, but he's obviously not starting in the same kind of manner. So it's one thing to replace well. Bournemouth have been doing this for a while. But it's another thing to replace players who are now considered amongst the top talents in world football. That's exactly what they've done. And under the stewardship of Andoni Iraola, Bournemouth continue to go from strength to strength. And in Antoine Semenyo, they might have the player of the season so far from a Premier League perspective. 6 goals and 3 assists in 9 games. Only Erling Haaland's freakish goal-scoring form has put him ahead of Semenyo in the goal involvement rankings. And he's been an absolute delight to watch all season long, unless he's playing against your team. Diakate and Milosavljevic have both been given opportunities to partner Marcos Senesi at centre-back. Both, I think, have impressed on different occasions. The young Serbian, I thought, was excellent in the win over Forest at the weekend. And the centre midfield partnership of Alex Scott and Tyler Adams is mighty impressive. Another change from last year, because it feels like after both had suffered injuries, you know, we saw Ryan Christie in there, we saw Cook in there, and suddenly it feels like Adams and Scott have this partnership. Now, those of you who listen on the Patreon will know that at the start of the season, we were talking about players we thought might break out. I talked a bit about Alex Scott in that episode. We were just discussing the fact that it's about the fact he's waited for his opportunity. He's been hamstrung, no pun intended, by injuries over the course of the last couple of years. And finally, he's getting that opportunity. And I think the Scott and Adams in there is such a beautifully crafted partnership for what Iraola wants to do. You know, Scott gets forward, he's unleashing shots from outside the box, he's dancing around players like he did back at Bristol City. And Adams is this kind of workhorse-esque midfielder who is so smart in terms of where he intercepts the ball, where he picks things up. We've spoken at length about the fact that Ryan Christie felt like a player transformed under Iraola. You know, he went from an attacking midfielder, a winger at times at Celtic, to someone who was just like an absolute pit bull terrier in the middle of the pitch, winning balls back and winning back possession high up and making turnovers for this team. And suddenly it feels like this partnership might have the capacity to go one further and really pull it together. And I was reading a piece from Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian the other day, and I thought I'd pull it up because he says, you know, of Iraola, Bielsa's influence on him can be seen in the press and the way that they run with the ball, that verve, that sense of energy. And last year, Pep Guardiola was talking about the fact that football had moved on from the kind of positional senses that he'd put their juego de posición, that he had helped to kind of cultivate. And he pointed out Bournemouth as one of the teams who were kind of like driving forward this new era of what the Premier League was going to look like. And we see that again, right? Like, there are so many things to like about this team. I just point out finally on Bournemouth, Eli Junior Krupi deputizing brilliantly for Evan Nilsson at the moment. 3 goals in his last 2 games. I would say more smart scouting, but I do think it's always worth pointing out that he came from Lorient, who are Bournemouth's sister club, and they forced this move through by like rejecting bids of double what Bournemouth paid for Eli Junior Krupi to go to other teams. So there is that worth considering, but still, it's about someone who fits into the system, someone who will come in and be able to adapt to the Premier League. And so far, so good from that perspective. A double last weekend against Palace and a goal this weekend against Nottingham Forest. It all just feels like it's really clicking into place for Bournemouth.
Yeah, and I think that some teams are going to make the mistake of thinking if you stop Semenyo, you stop Bournemouth. Seen it a couple of times now where it's felt a little bit like if you can get 2 players onto Semenyo, then maybe you can limit the way that they play. And that's just not true. I think Nottingham Forest might have fallen victim to that at the weekend. Like Bournemouth's tactics at the weekend, they were so good. The way that they just camped in Nottingham Forest half and just pushed them back, like they couldn't get out. Like for the first 20 minutes of that game, Forest were just like stuck. They didn't know how to get out, and it was just relentless how Bournemouth were just like moving the ball forwards, moving it different angles. And it was just a matter of time. I mean, they obviously ended up getting the breakthrough from a corner kick, which wasn't part of the plan, but whatever. You take these things as you can get them, and then Krupi scores the goal. And he's going to be a great asset. Like I've seen comparisons to Jermaine Defoe from Bournemouth fans starting to creep in. That's started to be talked about recently. But certainly he's got something different about him from most players that you see in the Premier League. And his teammates are talking about him very fondly so far. But I just think that with Scott and Adams and the tenacity that they've got, but also the brains, that works really well. Semenyo's creativity, I don't have him quite down as the player of the season yet. Personally, I'd have Gabriel probably, right, for all-round contribution, given what Arsenal are managing to do. But the fact that Semenyo is being sandwiched into a conversation between Gabriel and Haaland tells you that he's doing something right this season at Bournemouth. And that whether they can hold on to him long term, I doubt. But as a Bournemouth fan, you might not even be too concerned about that, because you think, hang on, the way that we're recruiting, the way that we've made up for losing 70% of our defence from last year and coming through that to be a better team, means that maybe we can find somebody that takes us on from where we are with Semenyo. Maybe there's one of the guys on the fringe now that gets their chance more regularly and steps forward again. There are players starting to come back into this team now and into this squad that's giving them more depth. And they've actually got a really good side built out here that makes you wonder just how far they can go. It's a good measuring stick, actually. They've got Man City coming up at the weekend, because it's the perfect time for them to go and try something like that, because they can afford to lose, right? They can go play their way absolutely fearlessly, because if they lose, they lose. Like, at the point when you're second in the table after 9 games, you actually begin the game 2 points ahead of Man City already. It's a fantastic situation to kick off in. And I have some concern for Man City playing against a team with that kind of mindset, because they're just going to not be afraid to implement their own style on City, and they probably won't enjoy it, because City themselves are lacking a physicality about them at the moment that's quite strange to see missing. And I think Bournemouth can make the most of that, because they've got a good mixture of brawn and brains, I think. And the fact that they're so sharp in that attacking third says a lot. So, look, Nottingham Forest, obviously, a difficult team to gauge at the moment because they're transitioning to a new manager. But the fact that they were seen off almost effortlessly in that first half performance just shows you like where Bournemouth are right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, also just a word on Iraola, because he has been talked about as one of the smartest and best managers in the Premier League, which, you know, kind of in the general sense of it, puts him in that conversation for smartest and best managers in world football, right? Not necessarily it's bar for bar, but it puts you into that conversation. And it is worth pointing out that patience is a virtue, right? Because you'll remember that Antonio Raiola replaced Gary O'Neill at Bournemouth. Not everyone else was particularly happy about it. And after 9 games, 0 wins, 3 draws, 6 losses, 20 goals conceded in that time, well, it looked like it could be curtains for Raiola. And then they went on a streak where they won 8 games out of 9, I believe. And, you know, the turnaround and what he's done in the period, you know, to right now, that truly, truly remarkable, you know, what he's put together with this Bournemouth side. So deserves a lot of love, I think, for that. And look, he's someone who speaks really candidly about the way he wants to manage and what he wants to do. I think that the fact is that we're talking about a manager who is quite special, and it makes me very happy. And Ndidi Ariola is now getting the plaudits that he deserves. So yeah, shouts out to Bournemouth. Look, do I think they will finish second in the Premier League? No. But do I think that they can be in that conversation for the Europa League spots and definitely, and even if the Champions League goes down to 5, can they be in that conversation?
Maybe.
I don't think that that's worth ruling out at this stage, considering the way that they're playing and considering that kind of newfound depth that you were talking about a little while ago. Last year, they were, you know, running on bare bones at times and still managing to grind out results. And that's the Iraola effect, and, you know, one of the world's best man managers. I think the Bournemouth, their position's probably slightly false, and this episode is kind of trying to work out where these surprise packages, you know, might end up. But I do think they will be in that conversation for, if not the last Champions League spot, then very much the Europa League spots below. Let's go from the south of the country to the north quickly. And I want to just briefly touch on Sunderland. Like, I think a lot of people would have expected Sunderland to be the first name on this list. And whilst I totally appreciate that, I do just want to say that we have a full Sunderland episode coming on The Truth on Friday. Doogie and I are going to dive just into just what's made the start of this season so impressive from their perspective and how far they can take that. So make sure you're locked in on Friday for a full Black Cat slowdown. We're not going to go too in-depth here because there's plenty for us to get through over the course of an hour. But being currently fourth in the Premier League, 5 points behind Arsenal, 1 point behind Bournemouth and Spurs. Just a quick kind of rundown. In the summer, they lost Joe Bellingham, Tom Watson, and then a couple of players who were important in the Championship, but didn't look that we're going to get a look in from a Premier League perspective in Paddy Roberts, Jensen Selt, and Alan Brown. But in came permanent deal to make Enzo Lefebvre's loan, you know, a done thing. Then Habib Diarra, Noah Siddiqui, Reynildo Mandava, Chemsedin Taubi, Simon Adingra, Granit Xhaka, Robin Roofs, Arthur Masuaku, Omar Alderete, Nordi Mukiele, Brian Brobby, Bertrand Traore, and Lucherelle Hertroyda. That's a lot of names. And whilst I think that just on the basis of this, a newly promoted side being fourth in the Premier League warrants their inclusion in a conversation like this, but there was also a little bit of scorn being thrown around at Sunderland in the way that they recruited and the amount of players that they came through the door. And look, I think that people have been burned. We saw Fulham spend 100-odd million pounds one summer and go straight back down and not be able to deal with the consequences of that particularly well. We saw Nottingham Forest throw a lot of money at the wall. We saw Aston Villa throw a lot of money at the wall and survive by the skin of their teeth. Both of them. And I think people were looking at this Sunderland team who came up through the playoffs, who conceded far more goals than either of the other two promoted sides last season, who were miles back in terms of where they were and where they finished in the championship last year, and thought, well, how are you going to find any continuity? But Regis Labrice has done an absolutely sensational job of bedding these players into this team. And I think people will look at the Sunderland goals against Chelsea if they just saw the short highlights and say, oh, they scored a 96-minute winner. They've smash and grabs Chelsea. That isn't what happened. That's not the way that the game played out. Sunderland came with a game plan and they executed it to perfection. And whilst every game hasn't been perfect, they were pretty poor against Manchester United a couple of weeks ago. They were really poor against Burnley before that. The way that they've gone about their business, especially in games against teams who should have more punching power than this Sunderland side, have put them right in contention for, you know, getting the early doors and the early jump on survival. Now, look, worth pointing out, Sunderland had a soft schedule to begin with. They had a relatively easy start. And they're going to have a very difficult period in December where not only do the fixtures become far more tricky, but also they're going to lose a lot of players to AFCON as well. So it's going to be a real test of the depth within this squad. But that doesn't take away from what has been an incredible start. No team has ever been relegated after a start like this, after being newly promoted. And they've put themselves right in the heart of that kind of, you know, are Sunderland going to get to the Champions League? No, I don't think so. Like, let's not. But I don't think Sunderland fans will be there being like, nah, from this good start, we need to get Champions League football. It's about getting over the line and making sure they reestablish themselves as a Premier League club. And on that front, and with that trajectory and ambition, they are well ahead of schedule.
Yeah, I mean, they won't go down. I'm pretty sure they won't go down because it's the players that have come in look like they belong. Like they might not have been all like immediately recognizable names that you could see doing well in the Premier League, but the recruitment's clearly been very smart here to find players that could quickly come together, and obviously there's still hope involved, but whether it's tactically or physically, they're matching people week after week. And the last two games kind of tell you everything you need to know, because they've had a home fixture against Wolves, the worst team in the league, and they've had an away fixture against Chelsea, who should be one of the best teams in the league. And they've won both of them. And the manner of the Wolves one was just as impressive as the Chelsea one. Because what Wolves have got is a physicality about them and is something that's, you've got to match, but then also come up with your moments. For that match, for example, Mukiele was like unbelievable. I like Mukiele anyway. I like everything I've seen from him. But what's amazing about Mukiele is that he's everywhere. And it's like, he's either like, whichever part of the defense he's playing in, and they can move him around, he's proved to be adaptable. It doesn't really matter, because he'll like take the long throws over on like the left wing as well, because he'll launch one in. And it was actually in that Wolves game that he ended up doing that. So like he scores from actually the left channel, which is the complete opposite side of the field to where he's actually supposed to be playing. But because he's just taken his throw from up there, but he's still up there when the ball's kind of coming into the next phase. And he ends up scoring from there. He's a really difficult player to gauge. And he's not the only one in that sense. Like Sunderland players are just proving to be adaptable to circumstances. And they're just coming together. It's really, really impressive. Even the goalkeeper, Rofe's like, what a season he's had so far. Like one of the best signings so far. I think Mukiele, 12 million. Like right, these guys like have been put together like on a good budget. Like they've done really well to pull them all in. And then they go to Chelsea. And yes, it's a late win, but it's a win that deserved, maybe. Like maybe deserved. Like, it's not one that Chelsea fans could be like, oh my God, what a smash and grab. Didn't feel like that. So they're in a very good position now. I definitely am taking them seriously as a team that can assert themselves in the division. Their fans seem so excited that they've come here to actually have a go. Because that fear is always there that you're just going to get smashed everywhere you go. And when you're building a new team, that can easily happen. But there's a genuine belief in this team that they are Premier League quality. And I do think that the Premier League's different this season. I think that the directness, the long throws, the physical approach, well, it helps teams come up from the Championship and survive because they can match you in all those areas. It'll be technically, it'll be tactically that you might be able to outwit them. But if you're just looking for battles, well, Sunderland will be there every day of the week and then they'll have a bit more. So yeah, I really do think, mate, that they've done enough already to convince me that they'll be staying up.
I think what's really impressive is also the fact that, like, pretty much all of the signings have already made a difference in some shape or form. Like, you look at it and you say, okay, Enzo Lefebvre didn't start the season in the team, but has worked his way in and looks really good off that left-hand side rather than the number 10 you expected him to. Habib Diarra starts the season really well and then gets injured. And Noah Siddiqui basically just picks up the mantle and goes, no worries, I got this, alongside Granit Xhaka in the middle of the park. Reinildo's played, you know, a good amount on that left side and been impressive. Chemsedin Taubi scores the winner, obviously, against Chelsea, but has been excellent. You'd say Simon Adingra, who was the one that a lot of people were really excited about, has maybe made the least impact of their signings from everyone that they've brought in. Jack has been amazing. Yeah, you said Roofs has been amazing. Masuaku, maybe, okay, he might be the one that's made the least impact. But, you know, coming off the bench, Alderete has been good. Mukiele has been good. Brobbey sets up that goal at the weekend with some really good hold-up play and is able to kind of change it up and play in a different style. Bertrand Traore has had more minutes than I think people were expecting. Feels like a bit of a Ryan Babel at Fulham situation where Bertrand Traore has come back a little bit older, a little bit wiser with a point to prove. And here Troida comes into the team at the weekend and looks absolutely rock solid. So, like, I just look at it and think this is very impressive. They're putting together a very, very good side and no one was expecting it to start this fast. But it's been very, very good. Mm. And yeah, as I say, more on that on Friday. Diggy and I will be looking at Sunderland in a bit more depth on the truth. Let's go over to Serie A quickly and talk about Roma, who are currently second in Serie A, level on points with last year's champions, Napoli. Now, last season, Roma finished fifth. They were 13 points off the Scudetto, but even that was only due to a remarkable turnaround when Claudio Ranieri came into the club, parachuted in really to save the season. And in the summer, they appoint Giampiero Gasperini, who leaves Atalanta after a decade in Bergamo, and he basically oversaw the club's most successful period in their history. There wasn't too many changes in the summer. Leandro Paredes went out. Mats Hummels retired. Eldor Shomurodov, who's sort of been there for a while but has never really cracked the first team, ends up departing as well. And they bring in Neil El Ainoui. They bring in Wesley to play at right wing back. Evan Ferguson comes in. Leon Bailey comes in. Kostas Tsimikas comes in. Some of those on loan. And the difference, I think, is that Roma have been the best defense in Serie A so far this season. They've conceded just 3 goals. And I just want to point out here that whilst this is obviously early days and there's a couple of teams on 4 and a couple of teams on 5, so it's not like they're streaming away with this, but the team with the best defense in Serie A usually wins the title. Napoli last season, Inter the year before, Napoli in 22-23, Milan in 21-22, Inter in 2021. The list goes on and on and on and on. So the team who has the best defense usually comes in and ends up winning the title. Now, this isn't what you expected when Gasperini rolled into this Roma side, right? You looked at the players at his disposal, you looked at Dybala and Matias Sula and Evan Ferguson coming in on loan and Artem Dovbik, who won the La Liga Pichichi just a couple of seasons ago playing for Girona. And you're looking at it and saying, okay, they're going to be uber offensive, right? Like, the Gasperini's Atalanta side basically became a buzzword for playing exciting, attractive, forward-thinking football. And yet, this Roma are low scorers and solid at the back. Evan Ndika, Mario Hermoso, and Gianluca Mancini look like a really well put together, really well balanced back three. And actually, the only thing I would criticize Gasperini from a defensive front is in the game against Inter, he switched Ndika and Hermoso and played them on the opposite sides. And they basically got caught out by a couple of different offside traps and it didn't look as natural. He's brought them back and what do you know? They keep a clean sheet at the weekend. But like in front of them, Manu Kone absolutely bossing teams in midfield, whoever he's paired with. And I think the really interesting thing is I expect Roma to get better from an attacking perspective. I expect to see more from them. Now, we've seen a couple of different elements of this. Against Sassuolo at the weekend, Gasperini deployed Paulo Dybala as a false nine. He scores the only goal of the game. And Brian Cristante, who's been kind of remolded into a defensive midfielder at Roma, moves further up, which he did earlier in his career. Cristante takes a shot, it bounces out, Dybala scores. And Neil Arnui came in alongside Kone in the middle. He looked really good since his move from Lens, and more on them later. But I think what's interesting is that Gasperini clearly doesn't have the players he needs to do his thing from an attacking perspective. Leon Bailey has now come back into the mix. So we're going to see if he is able to help spark this. There's talk already about the fact that they might look for a different striker in January. But I think that, you know, Gasperini will look to find solutions with either Ferguson or Dovbyk, you know, before it gets to that moment. I don't think he's going to sit here and be like, yeah, it's just going to be rubbish from an attacking perspective until we get to the January window and then we try and change things. I'd imagine he's going to try and work these players into form. And if that attacking unit gets firing with the defensive basis that he's already put in here, well, suddenly we could be talking about Roma as Scudetto contenders. And whilst I thought they would improve over the course of this season, I did not think that I would be sitting here talking about Roma as the best defensive unit under Giampiero Gasperini when it came to towards the end of October. I think that's what makes this so exciting, right? Like Dybala's goal at the weekend will be a relief. He was a bit of a Serie A scoring drought before that. Mattia Sula has been their most authentic attacking threat, and he looks now like the player that we thought he was going to be when he swapped Juve for Roma 2 years ago. And you can see that because Italy have basically made a load of overtures to him to start representing them instead of Argentina, which he has batted back and be like, no way, I'm going to be in the Argentina team. Don't worry about it, pal. So, you know, you can see that he's got that confidence as well. A couple of the signings have looked pretty good. I said El Anoui there a little bit. Wesley's looked impressive when he's played. He's rotating with Divine Wrench on that right-hand side. Simakas yet to catch fire, I think, is probably the fairest way to put that one. He hasn't had too many games so far. Their home form's been a bit patchy, and they play Parma tonight, if you're listening to this on Wednesday when it drops. So we'll see how this one ages. But I'm getting a very, very excited about this Roma side, not from the way that they're playing football, but from the fact that I wasn't expecting them to play like this. And I think it will get better in the area that they're lacking with Gasperini at the helm. And if he can balance that with making sure that it sticks as a tight level at the back, then suddenly we could be on for something pretty special here, especially with Napoli looking a little bit ropey at times, with Inter looking a little bit ropey at times this season, with Milan looking good, but not completely there and in a kind of rebuilding season under Allegri. I wonder if Gasperini can slide under the radar a little bit here and what we might see towards the end of the season.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I kind of assume that this attacking dilemma is going to cost them before they get to January. But yeah, I guess if he's the man that might know how to change that, I mean, that would make sense. I am concerned about why this isn't working so far, like why these guys, the goals have dried up. But to have got a second in the league with like these sorts of numbers is pretty strange, right? Like it's a very weird levels of output in terms of goals scored and goals against. Not what we were expecting at all, but it's working. And so expect the unexpected is probably the best thing to do with them for right now. And they can kind of ride this wave and see where it takes them. I definitely wouldn't have had them being in this position at this stage. But the longer that they can just keep themselves on fine margin games, then they've got a possibility of getting to that January window and trying to fix it. There's a lot of games, obviously, between now and the end of the year. So we're talking like a big part of the campaign. But so far, so good, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, also, I do believe that Gasperini has the coaching chops to get a tune out of a Dovbyk or a Ferguson. It's just about finding a balance within this front three and making it stick.
Yeah, Ferguson does seem weird, doesn't it? Like, the whole situation around Ferguson seems a bit strange. So it'll be interesting to see that, because there's now talk of him coming back already in January. So that seems conceivable as we sit here right now, because why would they carry on with that deal when they could get somebody else through the door who can actually score a goal?
Oh, sure. Like, as in, if it carries on like this until January, then there's absolutely no way he's going to be there in the second half of the season. But like, I don't think that Gasperini can afford to wait until January to try and get one of these two strikers firing. So we'll see. But yeah, a very good start to the season for Roma. I thought they'd be involved in 4-3 thrillers, not a load of 1-0 wins.
Exactly.
But, you know what? They all count the same and they're all 3 points. You just have to ask Arsenal. Anyway, we're going to take a break there when we come back and talk a little bit about the Bundesliga, about Liga and about La Liga as well. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to the third and final part of this Ranks FC podcast. Jack Collins and Dean Jones alongside you. And DJ, shall we go to Germany?
Yes, let's do it, mate. What have you found from the Bundesliga generally? Before you go into like the actual like specifics of who you think is overperforming, because I am actually enjoying Bundesliga this season. It's possibly my second favourite league. I like it.
There you go. I mean, I've very much dialed into Serie A this season, and as usual, okay. And it kind of sits in fourth spot for me. I love La Liga.
Does it?
I always kind of have. And then, you know, the fact is that Serie A I find incredibly entertaining, and that there seems to be a new winner every season at the moment. So, like, I think that there's loads to keep an eye on. But I've been intrigued by some of the bits and bobs going on in the Bundesliga. The slide from St. Pauli, the fact that Gladbach can't seem to buy a win at the moment is absolutely brutal. But, you know, having the derby back, the Hamburg derby between those two, and them two sort of battling it out at the bottom of the campaign, the fun that Augsburg started with, and now it's just a bit all over the place. Union Berlin starting badly and then kind of finding some form at this point. Like, I found it really intriguing to see how things are going. And look, Kasper Hjulmand's appointment at Leverkusen has been, you know, a bit transformative from in terms of their league standing and where they've been. So yeah, there's a lot to like, and I think we're going to have a really interesting battle for the Champions League spot.
Yeah.
I think as usual, we're going to have a really good battle at the bottom as well for the relegation places. But yeah, I still kind of maintain that it sits a little bit lower down my priority list, but my kind of favourites to watch list than yours. But one team I have really been enjoying, Dean, are RB Leipzig. And currently second in the Bundesliga, 5 points behind league leaders Bayern. This might sound a bit nuts, but like after the summer they had, last season's chaos and their 6-0 battering from Bayern on the opening day, I've been really, really impressed with how they've bounced back. Now, Leipzig finished seventh last season, right? Their lowest league position since 2016. And that was when they were promoted to the Bundesliga. And since promotion, they'd never finished outside the Champions League spots. Now, it was a bit of a mess in terms of the managerial aspect of it. Marco Rosa was there till March and then Zolt Lowe took over. And it just never felt like Leipzig properly got going last year. And what that led to was this exodus from the club, right? So out the door go Lois Appenda, Benjamin Sheshko and Xavi Simons, plus Lucherel Hirtreuder on loan to Sunderland. That's their three top scorers from last season, the only three players that scored double figures across 2024-25, and two of their top three assist providers as well. Appenda got 11 and Xavi Simons got 8. Oli Werner came in as the new head coach after that whole disaster last season, and he'd come in from Werder Bremen. Now, he'd done a good job. He'd got Werder Bremen promoted back to the Bundesliga and had settled them kind of in the middle of the pack, but there's still a jump up, right? There's still a kind of level of, okay, someone's gone from Holstein Kiel to Werder Bremen, who are a massive club, but are not kind of in this period where they're challenging for European football. To go to a Leipzig side that needed to bounce back from one, a position of, you know, they need it from a financial perspective. And two, you're looking at it and saying, okay, so here you go. You're walking into the club. It's a bit Keith Andrews-y, although with more experience. You're walking in, you're losing your three best players. Good luck. And you're like, okay, cool. How do we do? The opening night, as we say, sees them whacked 6-0 by Bayern as they completely crumbled. But since then, played 7, won 6, drawn 1 against Borussia Dortmund, scored 16, conceded 3. And they are back on the youth hype in terms of signing. So in the summer, they bring in 23-year-old Romelu Cardoso from Göztepe in Turkey for 20 million euros. They bring in 22-year-old Johan Bakayoko for 18 million euros from PSV. 21-year-old Max Finkrava for 4 million from Köln. 20-year-old Konrad Harder for 24 million from Sporting. 20-year-old Ezequiel Banzuzi for 16 million from Leuven in Belgium. Andrea Maksimovic, who's 18, for 14 million euros from Sverne Zvezda, and 18-year-old Jan Diamande for 20 million euros from Leganés. And look, they make a profit, right? Like in terms of their summer business at the same time. So a couple of these have hit the ground running in a big way. Bakayoko and Antonio Nusso, who was a bright spot last year, have formed this incredibly dangerous wing combination either side of Romelu, who really feels like he's starting to find his rhythm. Yeah. He started every game since the Bayern game. He's been the main man in this unbeaten run, picked up 3 goals and 3 assists in those 7 games. Jan Diamande has been really dynamic off the bench. He's earned himself a starting spot against Augsburg, and he picked up his first Bundesliga goal, meaning he's now scored in both of his Leipzig starts, one in the league, one in the DFB Pokal. But I think maybe the most interesting story of the lot is Christoph Baumgartner, right? Like, who is a player that I adore. So anyone was listening to your previews of the Euros or even the World Cup in 2022 and talking about Austria, I love Baumgartner. And he is absolutely flying. He's 2 goals off his best ever Bundesliga tally. He's played in 8 games. And like, you're looking at it, he's already eclipsed last year, and he's really finding himself thriving in that creative gap left open by Xavi Simons' departure. Plus the fact that there is a slight switch in the formation, which means he's playing in that number 10 role. He's enjoying being the main man in there. So I'm really excited to see what Baumgartner can put together when he's given the kind of keys to the castle in the creative role. But there's a couple of others too. The emergence of Asan Uadrogo as the starting box-to-box number 8. He signed from Schalke last summer, but he was out injured for much of the season. So he kind of needed a fresh start. And he got his opportunity from Ole Werner quite early on. He's taken it with both hands. He earned his first start against Köln in week 4, and he's just not let go of that place. A hugely energetic presence in the middle. He's making inroads both in and out of possession. Leipzig, I think, have another gem on their hands here in terms of a central midfield role. And just a quick shout out to a few of the older heads who've been excellent. David Raum feels like he's adjusted to the captaincy really nicely, whilst Willie Orban seems to have been freed by that captaincy taken off his shoulders. His partnership with Castello Luqueba is going from strength to strength at the moment. And part of that seems to be the consistency of it, because like, it was moved around so much last year, the back four, and now it looks really settled. And part of that is Ridley Baku, right? He joined in January, but finally it feels like he's been used in his best position at right back. Rosa and Soltler have used him exclusively, almost exclusively, at right wing last year. But he's back in his original position, which is where so much of the German public got excited about him coming through in the first place, right? He's been sensational and earned himself a recall to the national team as well, where he got a couple of caps in the last international break. And I think with Leipzig, there's more to come too. But I think we're going to see more from Diamande and Maksimovic as the season goes on. I think Konrad Harder too, he's got a job to try and dislodge Romelu. But like, the reason he left Sporting was that he didn't want to play second fiddle, right? To Luis Suarez, not that one. But like, he left because he didn't get given the opportunity to be the main man. And he's come in at Leipzig now and he finds Romelu in front of him. And so I expect him to put up a fight for that role as well. There's also 19-year-old Tidiam Gomis, who joined in January, and Banzuzi to come into the fray. And Werner appears to have stabilized his club that were absolutely all over the place last season. I have complete faith that they will be back in the Champions League next season. They look really, really good. There's depth pieces there. They've gone back to bringing through talent. And suddenly it looks like there could be like an absolute heap of gems on Leipzig's plate once again. And it's been really, really fun to watch, kind of culminating in that 6-0 win at the weekend where they were irrepressible.
Yeah, it's funny that they've come full cycle from losing 6-0 to Bayern to winning 6-0 last weekend. But honestly, it was like, in a way, it was like a reality check, that first game of the season. And I'm not saying a 6-0 defeat is ever good for anyone, but like, it might not have been the worst thing in the world because they bounced straight back. And actually, it was Baumgartner, their first game after Bayern. I remember watching it. They played Heidenheim and Baumgartner was inspirational. And like, it was a really strong performance that day from Leipzig. And they just put that game behind them immediately and they haven't looked back. They kept going. They've kept picking up results. They've mainly picked up wins since then. And they look a solid team who also just have that edge, often from Baumgartner, but there are others around him too who can turn it on. And yeah, they're definitely one of the best sides to watch. And they're one of the reasons that I said there at the top that I'm enjoying Bundesliga is because, yes, it's really below Bayern. It's very competitive. But they've all got like these, they've got players that will just like turn a game. And that's what I like about Bundesliga this season. There are so many players who have just got a creative spark about them. And it's just a really good league to watch.
Yeah, fair enough. Like, it has been a lot of fun. It's always been fun watching Leipzig down the years. Last year was a bit of a, ooh, what's happened to them? And yeah, suddenly they're back in business. So no, I'm excited to see where they develop. Let's go to Spain. Let's talk about Espanyol. They're fifth in La Liga behind the big three and Villarreal after 10 games. They've won half those games. They've lost just twice this entire season to Real Madrid at the Bernabeu and once at home to the mighty Real Betis. So that's fair enough. But in that time, they've beaten Atletico Madrid with a dramatic late comeback win in the season opener. But whilst the other names they've beaten are nowhere near as illustrious as that, this is major, major progress for a team who literally won on the final day of last season to stay in the division. And especially given that they lost their best player in the summer. So Joan Garcia obviously traded size of the city when he joined Barcelona. They activated his 25 million euro buyout clause. And given that without Garcia, who was the best keeper in La Liga last season by my money, they would have been relegated. I think this has been an incredible turnaround for Los Periquitos. So for some context, there were major changes over the summer at Espanyol. The club was bought by Velocity Sports Partners, who are owned by American businessman and the fellow that also owns Burnley, Alan Pace. It took over from a Chinese ownership that sort of overseen this period of financial instability, inability to buy players until those costs were reined in. Spending was under control. We know what the La Liga kind of caps are like in terms of being able to offer wages to players, etc. Right? And Pace came out. He said, look, it's not about ownership. It's about stewardship. And he made a really interesting point. He said, Burnley will remain Burnley. Espanyol will remain Espanyol. Each club keeps its own leadership, identity, independence and decision-making run by its own people for its own supporters. Mm. And that financial security combined with the sale of Joan Garcia allowed Espanyol to keep hold of Javi Puado, who was the captain, who's been really crucial to this Espanyol team down the years. And also to kind of make permanent the loan deals of Roberto Fernandez from Braga, Urco Gonzalez from Real Sociedad, and they extended the one from Villarreal for left-back Carlos Romero. There weren't too many other signings made for significant fees, but a heap of free transfers and loan deals sanctioned, right? So we know from the market that free transfers tend to demand bigger wages. So they bring in veteran bagsman Kike Garcia from Alaves, who scored 15 times last season and was one of the reasons that they nearly went down in the first place, right? Experienced keeper Marco Dimitrovic, young defender Clemens Riedel, and the seemingly somewhat rogue addition of Tyrese Dolan from Blackburn Rovers, who's been really impressive thus far in La Liga. And they bring in a couple of loans as well. Ramon Terraz on loan from Villarreal and Luca Colioscio on loan from Burnley. But still, Dolan's a really interesting one, right? Like, he played mostly on the left for Blackburn, like cutting inside, but he's worked himself into this Espanyol side on the right. He holds the width a lot of the time, puts in some really good crosses for a formidable physical front two to attack. And he's picked up a couple of assists now already. He's causing a nuisance though. And every time he gets the ball, you see the stadium sort of light up a little bit. And they've come up with some, you know, some nice ones in terms of nicknames. I like personally Dolandinho, but also apparently Maradolan has come into the vernacular around Espanyol as well. Okay. But he's been really impressive. Another intriguing case is Edu Exposito, right? He's 29 years old now, plays in the heart midfield. He currently sits alongside Real Madrid pair Kylian Mbappe and Arda Güler as the players who've contributed the most key passes in the division this season, which shows the impact that he's had on this Espanyol team. And given it was just towards the back end of last season that he returned from an ACL injury, that return to form has been pretty staggering. And I want to just shout out the manager, Manolo Gonzalez. Relatively young, relatively inexperienced. He deserves major, major credit. He was parachuted in to the first team in March 2024 from the B team in the Segunda, led them to promotion via the playoffs, and then oversaw a second half of the season turnaround last year to survive by the skin of their teeth on almost no budget whatsoever. He has been caricatured a bit. He's a former bus driver. But with more tools at his disposal this year, we've seen far more tactical nous from him than we did last year. He's changed games late on, like the Atleti game where they're 1-0 down and they go on to win it 2-1. He switched up his styles to win individual games and kind of a real tactical merit. He's a smart cookie. And the fans are really taken to him. He's got like a quite a gruff manner, but he clearly cares for the club deeply. And given the ups and downs of the last decade, I think that the fans have really kind of bought into what he's trying to do. I do think Espanyol will drop off a little bit. There are still clubs below them with more to their game than Espanyol. But I think they'll probably be in contention alongside the likes of Rayo and Athletic for those European places in La Liga, which is a huge, huge turnaround from where they were last season.
Very good, mate. Yeah, this is definitely a storyline that I didn't know as much about. So you've kind of got me up to speed here. I'm sure I'm not the only one. But yeah, even if they are knocked out of fourth and down to fifth, that's not bad after 10 games, is it? They're very nicely positioned. And yeah, you never know. They might be able to stay in the mix by the sound of things.
I think they probably will. Like, it's quite interesting. And look, Pace spoke about it and he was like, look, there's two big clubs in this city, Barcelona and Espanyol. Why not, you know, have that rivalry mean something like an Atleti, yeah, Real Madrid, right? Like, how can we build it to be out like that? So we'll see what the development looks like and what the investment looks like. But so far, so good from that kind of reign or this new tenure at Espanyol.
That's cool. Nice one.
Going from one thing you don't know about to another thing you definitely don't know about. Let's go to Liga.
Yeah, I don't know about this, but I can guarantee you that you're about to fill me in with some more knowledge. Go.
Well, let's go to Lens, who are currently second in Liga, 1 point behind league leaders PSG. Two losses all season. Open day, 1-0 reverse to Lyon, and then they lost to PSG a couple of weeks ago. Since then, they hammered Lille 3-0 in the Derby du Nord. They scored a 96-minute winner when they had 10 men to beat Auxerre. They saw off upwardly mobile Paris FC. And perhaps most impressively, they saw off Marseille at the weekend to leapfrog them in the Ligue 1 standings. They finished eighth in Ligue 1 last season. And look, the big period of hope, you'll remember that second place finish in 22-23, where they put up an unexpected title challenge to PSG. Like, that hope felt like it was a long way in the rearview mirror when this season began. And the president, Joseph Orgulian, set out the club's number one objective before the season. And it was to rediscover financial solidity.
Oh,
which
lovely.
Is never the kind of thing that a fan wants to hear, right? Like, back in 2024, he announced that basically they were going into austerity, and a lot of the brilliant players that we've seen coming through at Lens in the last couple of seasons have basically all gone, right? The team was torn apart. So Seco Fofana and Lois Openda left the summer after they finished second. They followed out the door in the transfer windows that followed by almost every big name. So Abdoukir Kusunov, Brice Samba, Elia Wahi, Kevin Danso. Then this summer, they sold Neil El Ainoui to Roma, Andy Diouf to Inter, and they cashed in on that initial loan of Danso to Spurs to be made permanent. So they did bring in some players. They brought in Samson Baidoo and Mamadou Sangare, both for €8 million from the Austrian Bundesliga. And they coaxed Florian Thauvin back to France for €6 million from Udinese. More on him in a minute. But they also found a couple of smart bargains. Onsod Edouard from €3.7 million from Palace. Robin Riese for €3 million from Strasbourg. And Mathieu Udall for €3.5 million from Metz. All been impressive. But Lens still made a €30 million profit on their summer business to stabilize this financial situation. And friend of the pod, Luke Entwistle, who helped us with our French previews down the years, wrote in The Guardian, he said, over the last 5 years, only Lille, Monaco and Lyon have made more profit from transfers than Lens. The common thread about those clubs is that they develop talent, but Lens historically do not. Right. So this is a team that's having to basically play a trade to do things. So they have to keep this recruitment going. And look, Will Still was the manager last season. That one. Yeah. And given
they can probably have him back if they want.
Well, I don't think they want him back. Given the circumstances, an eighth place finish was probably a decent result, right? But on his departure in the summer, they moved to appoint Pierre Sage, the wise rock, who did a very, very good job with Lyon, but was replaced back in January by Paulo Fonseca, which felt a bit harsh at the time and looks even harsher now. And he's quashed any questions about whether he could work somewhere not called Lyon. He's brought together a dressing room that had been worried about how competitive they would be after losing yet more key players, which you can totally understand. Mm. And he's integrated these new signings seamlessly into his 3-4-2-1 system, which gets the best out of a number of key players. Look, Thauvin is the revelation. He left France back in 2021, 32 years old now. He left to play in Mexico. We had a really difficult stint at Tigres. And then Pizzi went to Udinese, where he kind of got his career back on track a little bit, but equally wasn't fit all the time. And most people in France had written him off, right? They shouldn't have. He is rolling back the years at Lens, scored two important goals already, including one in the derby. And he's just generally been their creative spark. But his work rate's through the roof and he's quickly become a fan favorite. And Didier Deschamps took notice as well. He was a part of the 2018 World Cup winning squad with France, but his return to the France squad in these international breaks was as heartwarming as it was unexpected, I think. And he's been absolutely sensational, but he's not the only one, right? Club captain Adrian Thomason looks reborn in this deeper midfield role. He's pulling the strings on the ball. He currently leads Ligue 1 for assists. And he's complemented nicely by the incredible off-ball work of Sangare. Whilst the three at the back has not just got the best out of new signing Samson Baidoo, who's been rock solid, by the way, but also players who were already at the club, like Malang Sarr, who might otherwise have been consigned to history as a footnote at Chelsea. Odson Edouard has got three goals to his name already after spending pretty much the whole season last year on the bench at relegated Leicester. Still only 27 years old, but this looks much more like the Celtic version than the Premier League edition of Odson Edouard. It's good to see French Eddie back in France in so many ways. And also in a setting that has a history of good goalkeepers, the gamble on Robin Riese seems to have paid off beautifully. 20 years old, his only real professional experience coming in a six-month loan with Red Star, where he kept them up in Ligue 2, and third tier Dijon, both while he was on loan from Strasbourg. He has come in and showed exactly why he was rated so highly as a youngster, made that step up look incredibly easy. And look, you talked about Robin Roof, see, earlier. It's a good year to be a young keeper called Robin R, apparently, if you're punching above your weight. There's a real togetherness about Lens that feels really contagious. They don't have the depth to deal with any major injury crises, but without European football to contend with, I expect them to be in the Champions League race in Ligue 1.
Wow. Mate, I don't know how, but you suddenly know more about Lens than I know about Fulham. So fair play to you, because I didn't know there's that many days in a week that you could watch all this football.
Yeah, I mean, look, when we set out this a couple of days ago, and you know, as a topic, I was like, right, I'm going to do some digging on these clubs that I'm intrigued
digging?
By.
So that was unbelievable.
So I've done some digging. I've done some digging on Lens, and that's what I found out.
That was good, mate. That was good stuff.
It was great. And look, actually, going back and watching load of their games and load of the highlights has been like an absolute joy. So, you know, getting those kind of extended 60-minute highlights and getting to watch Lens throughout this season. I caught a couple of the games live. I watched the derby, for example. But going back and seeing it and be like, wow, okay, there's more to this than just a really good performance in that one-off game, and kind of digging into it in that regard has been a bit of a joy. So, yeah, it was nice to see. But they have it. Six teams punching above their weight, or not punching above their weight, but surprising in one way or another, whether that's a team punching above their weight or whether it's kind of a sleeping giant who we didn't think were going to be at the races this year, but suddenly are right back where they would expect to be. There's six teams to keep an eye on in the near future as well. So all there's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. We'll be back on Friday with The Truth returning. Doug and I, as we say, are going to be taking a deep dive into Sunderland. So make sure you stick around for that one. But for now, thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you all very, very shortly, Ranks Squad. Take it easy. Peace.